Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation. Introducing the North Dakota recipients of the 2019 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2019 Bush Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows.
It's never too early to start estate planning. Join Prairie Public for a free lunch and learn financial and estate planning basics Tuesday, April 30th at 11:30 at Prairie Public's television studio in downtown Fargo. Explore important issues such as tax reform, charitable IRA giving, choosing an executor or a trustee, working with an attorney, and paying attention to who's in your will. Register online at prairiepublic.org/lunch or call me, Cassie Shipley, at 701-239-7538.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thanks for joining us on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. We're going to start our show today with a new book by an author who's actually been around for quite a while. Her name is Lorna Landvik, and Lorna's Main Street is now located in Minneapolis, but she was born in Grand Forks and spent her formative years in East Grand Forks, and she's been many other places since, which makes for an interesting background on which to build a writing and performing career. Chronicles of a Radical Hag with Recipes is Lorna Landvik's 12th novel. It has been described as a love letter to journalism, cooking, and small-town life in North Dakota and Minnesota. She spoke with Main Street's Ashley Thornburg from her home in Minneapolis.
Lorna, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here, Ashley. Thank you.
How do you describe Chronicles of a Radical Hag with Recipes?
It is a multi-generational story. Its main characters are Hayes Evans, who has been a long-term 50-year columnist at a small-town newspaper. She is beloved by her readership, and after she suffers a stroke, the newspaper's publisher, Susan McGrath, decides to reprint columns that she's written throughout the years until her hopeful recovery. She tasks her very sulky 14-year-old son to have a summer job helping them go through the pounds and pounds of paper archives. Hayes has saved all her columns, all the many reader responses that she collected. And then the story goes into Susan and her failing marriage, and Sam just trying to figure out who he is in this world. He thinks Hayes's words mean, you know, how can an old lady's words mean anything to a guy like himself? And he really learns the value of a story, you know, and it doesn't matter who's telling the story, it's what the story imparts. And his own love of reading and writing are sort of sparked by that. So it's a, we also go back into Hayes's young womanhood, and it's just a wild, fun ride with really, really good recipes.
What's the inspiration for the novel?
Well, usually I know I'm ready to write a novel when some characters come unbidden into my head, as Hayes did, and I knew right away that she was a newspaper columnist. Mm. She was shortly followed by Susan and her son, and so that's all I'm given, and so I start writing. And I guess I just wanted to put out there a voice who speaks to all of us, despite, you know, being called names by early trolls, you know, just because she's opinionated, some men in the town can't tolerate that, which is why she asks them to put down their boxing gloves and put on some baking mitts, oven mitts instead, and offers her a recipe. and that's kind of her little tongue-in-cheek joke. You know, it's like a little, okay, I'm sorry you were offended. I'm not sorry for my opinions, but here you go.
Can we talk this over almond crisps?
Right, right.
Yeah, it's possible that there, as I'm looking at my copy of the book, that there might be some butter that got on the edges of the book as I was nibbling and reading at the same time here.
That's That's the perfect condiment to have on your book page, on this particular book pages.
Well, we should introduce our listeners to Hazen and then talk a little bit more about the structure of the book, because these recipes are a character themselves here. So on page 14, you have a column that goes back to April 27th, 1964.
Yes. Cheerful greetings, readers. I was thrilled when the peach organza prom dress I sewed won a blue ribbon at the statewide 4-H Career Day competition, thrilled when I graduated UND with a degree in journalism, and thrilled when the Gazette hired me away from the Fargo Forum. To be thrilled is a lovely state of being, one that I again find myself in now that I'll be writing a bi-weekly column. Every year, my bachelor Uncle Ralph brought a different date to our family's holiday table, and one memorable Thanksgiving, he was accompanied by Carol Burgesson. Carol Burgesson! 13 years old and a recent graduate to the grown-ups table, I was not only beside Miss Burgesson, but beside myself. She may not be well known here in Minnesota, but in the Dakotas and states west, she was the reigning queen of the rodeo. And throughout the passing of mashed potatoes, turkey, and candied yams, I deliberated over what sophisticated and witty words I might say to impress her. I saw you at the Dunn County Fair, I finally offered, watching her drizzle gravy over her generously filled plate. You were wearing lots of fringe. I always wear fringe, darling, she said, except at the dinner table where it can get a little sloppy. She was the nicest woman, with a big laugh and a head full of wild red hair, and she regaled us with tales of bucking broncos and rodeo clowns with drinking problems. Moreover, she had all the time in the world for a strangely pale teenager who thought she'd hidden a pimply chin and forehead with liberal pats of her mother's powder puff. Uncle Ralph always whisked his dates away directly after dessert, not wanting, I suppose, to be part of the familial loosening of belt buckles, burps, and other noises repressed and unrepressed. And when they were leaving, Miss Burgesson shrugged into her luxurious dark fur coat and pulled me toward her. Now remember, Hayes, she whispered, everybody told me little girls didn't grow up to be rodeo stars. But I didn't listen to everybody. I listened to myself. If you want something, chase after it, rope it, and pull it in. It is advice that has served me well, and after Walter Peterson announced his retirement, I thought, that's something I want, his job. And so after it, I went. Why should I give a features writer her own column? Asked Mr. McGrath, this paper's publisher, a features writer who's only been with the Gazette for a year. Because I love a good story, I said, practically ejecting from my chair. I love hearing them, and I love telling them, and besides, I did a little research, and the Gazette hasn't had a female columnist since Ethel's Kitchen Nook, and that was ages ago. I believe it's been 4 years since Ethel took her retirement, said Mr. McGrath, who went on to tell me how Ethel had a point of view, and how people who read her columns knew they were going to get tips for making moist pot roast and cute stories about who first dared to add grated carrots to their Jell-O salad. Just like with Ramblin's by Walt, they knew they were going to get a sportsman's slightly curmudgeonly view of the world as well as how the fish were biting on Flame Lake. What will they know they're going to get with you? Who knows? We'll discover it together. I'll write what moves me, what riles me up or makes me sad, and just look at it from a business perspective, a column by a woman who could be the granddaughter of the columnist she's replacing. Well, it could bring in not just younger subscribers, but more women subscribers. The silence that followed was Grand Canyon-sized deep, finally broken by the muffled rat-a-tat-tat of the pencil Mr. McGrath tapped eraser side down on his desk blotter. And just as I thought he was going to tell me to get out of his office and pack up my desk, he sighed. All right, have your first column on my desk Monday morning. I'll give you a 6-week trial run to show me what you've got. So that's why I've written about Thanksgiving at the end of April, because I'm really grateful. Here we go. Wish me luck.
Lorna, it comes even more to life when you put on those accents as you're reading the book. We're visiting with Lorna Landvik. She is the author of Chronicles of a Radical Hag with Recipes. And that is the debut column of the main character here, Hayes Evans, who goes on to a 50-year career as a mostly beloved columnist in a small-town newspaper. Is there a real-life Hayes Evans who's the inspiration for this?
There is not to me, but I have been to several readings in smaller towns where they've told me, we had a columnist in Northfield, Minnesota, who always wore purple, and she was very opinionated, very beloved. Yesterday I was at a reading and signing, and a woman raised her hand and said, I'm from a small town in Iowa, and we had the only paper that was staffed entirely by women, and there was a beloved columnist there who really shaped my life. So I don't have any real-life inspiration other than the columnist that I read and still continue to read and enjoy. As a kid, I didn't get into Irma Bombeck until I got older and realized, wow, she really knows how to tell a story with wit and grace. And so Hayes just sort of guided me as to who she was and what she wanted to talk about. And, you know, in those 50 years, a lot happened, so it was really interesting for me to try to cull the national and international topics that she occasionally writes. Well, not occasionally. She often writes about, because she'll write both domestically what happens in her own life as well as what's happening in the broad world.
Well, the structure of the book is interesting to me, and I like that reading, not just because it's her first column, but it really ties together some elements that become apparent throughout the book. One, that, you know, she is starting out just sort of adorable, talking about this peach organza prom dress. So it's very cute, feminine at the beginning, but also you're wondering why, you know, as you're reading this, the date is April, and you're, why are you talking about this Thanksgiving meal that you got to somehow after talking about this peach organza prom dress? And you get the sense that, of course, good stories happen to good storytellers. She didn't live this sort of exotic life, but she's able to pull meaning from small events that happened throughout her life. And then as her column and as her voice progress, there is sort of this, if I may, quiet activism, quiet, the kind of feminism that is just, well, women work because we want to work sort of thing, because we're perfectly qualified to do so. And then we get this first reader response just immediately that includes a couple words here that the FCC won't even allow us to say on the air, but I'll summarize that Walt, the columnist she's replacing, basically suggests that she call her column puking on paper, and just finds it to be complete nonsense.
Yes, and he's afraid the readership that he spent 19 years building it will just not tolerate that sort of column. And it is another troll. And I was trying to think, boy, what did they call trolls back then?
Right. They existed before the Internet.
Right. Mr. Joseph Snell, who writes an inflamed letter to the paper after she writes a column about keeping her own last name and how, you know, she's newly married and her husband, a doctor, doesn't mind that she keeps her own name. But she asks him, her husband, what would you feel like if you had to take my name when we got married? And I wouldn't take it. And how, it's who I am. And then she asks, and how would you feel if you were sometimes referred to as the former, you know, Royal Kirby, that's his name.
Or the Mr. Hayes Evans.
Right. And so this guy writes in that, you know, her ravings are nothing but lunatic and coming from a radical hag. And he becomes her long-term nemesis, And so to mollify him after that first column, she writes, you know, she gives up one of her family's treasured recipes, the almond crescent cookies. And I actually did name them after my Aunt Elma, who was a lovely person and who would always share recipes if she had baked much, but she didn't. She taught at Concordia and was kind of a world traveler. She was pretty exotic. She lived in Fargo. But I just wanted to pay homage to her name. And so then throughout the book, she'll just offer up recipes as sort of a tongue-in-cheek joke, like, I know you think because I am a female columnist, this is part and parcel of what I have to say, but also because she just thinks it's a nice thing to do. Here you go, bake these, and you'll have a really sweet afternoon.
Bake out those frustrations. Is that what you
That's
do?
That's right. Bake, don't brood.
That should be a T-shirt here. Why did you want to structure the book the way that you did, where there is the present tense, where we're going through this story with the publisher, Susan, her failing marriage, her relationship with her sons, one of whom is still at home, and he's in that brooding teenager phase. Maybe he should bake a little bit more. And then you have the past with the Hayes Evans, and then her story told completely in the columns. You never hear from her, if you will. Why did you pick that structure?
I wish I could tell you, Ashley, but I really feel that I don't have that much say in the writing. Not that I'm not in charge, but I don't plan structure out. I don't outline. It's just how the story sort of comes to me. And I remember when I had, you know, seen that Hayes in my head was a columnist, I thought, oh, good, I'm going to get to write some columns. But I didn't know how Susan and Sam's story would come in and some other minor characters. There's an embittered newspaper receptionist and also Hayes's nurse, and they all have their stories told. And so I decided in the middle of the book, we leave the present and we do explore a secret that Sam comes upon about Hayes. And to me, that is the real fun of writing, the discovery, because I was almost just as surprised as Sam when he comes across some pretty, it could be considered incriminating material, and I think, whoa, that is going to be fun to write about. I have written books that... My second book, Your Oasis on Flame Lake, had five different narrators. Angry Housewives Eating Bonbons has different narrators, some who speak in the first person and some who prefer their stories told in third person. So I never really know how a story is going to come out until it really does.
So you're surprised by the things you're writing.
Yeah, and I would sometimes worry about my mental health if I, you know, didn't know that a lot of writers write the same way. It's, you know, there's pantsers and plotters, those of us who write by the seat of our pants and those who like to plot things out. And I'm sure many writers are a mixture of the two. But for me, I think outlining was really spoiled by my ninth grade English teacher's insistence that I couldn't write without an outline.
Visiting with Lorna Landvik, the author of Chronicles of a Radical Hag with Recipes. And Lorna, I was on your website. It's lornalandvik.com. And Landvik, in Vic, there is just the V-I-K. There's no C there. And I noticed one of your upcoming speaking engagements is you're going to be teaching a class called Lassoing the Muse Without Choking Her.
Yeah, the thing that distresses me about many people who want to write and yet are afraid to write is how to, you know, they can't overcome that fear that their stories aren't good enough, that the way they write isn't good enough. So for me, just having people realize the strength of their own voice and the courage to tell their own stories is really important, because who doesn't love a good story? And I believe that everybody has really good stories in them, but we all find a way to resist telling them, you know.
Well, I can't resist asking you, you got any good stories about temping in the Playboy Mansion?
Well, I do, actually. I lived in Los Angeles in my 20s, and having taken typing in ninth grade and, been a very competitive typer, I always wanted my name at the top of the blackboard as the fastest typist. That served me well in L.A. I got, temp jobs. I typed for the Olympics. I typed, at record companies, movie studios, and once my temp agent called and said, "We're sending you to the Playboy Mansion." And I, as a feminist, and I believe feminism is just that certain belief that we're all just people and we all get along best when we realize the people in all of us rather than just the sex. So I wasn't going to go there. I thought, no, I'm not going to go to the Playboy Mansion. And she assured me it was strictly clerical. So for 5 months, I would go to the mansion, the kitchen where breakfast to order was always available, climb the back staircase, the maid staircase, up to the third floor where Hugh Hefner's video room was. And so I typed a lot of labels, Miss September cuts ribbon at Ralph Supermarket. And then it led to a job, it was really fun, of watching old movies and writing synopses for them, because he was a big fan of old movies. I would occasionally see him in the hallways in his silk robe and a bottle of Pepsi in hand, and I would just sort of try to become invisible and just hug the wall as I passed him, not making eye contact, in my jeans and turtleneck, which weren't exactly Playboy wear. It was really interesting.
What are you working on next?
Well, I wish I could tell you, but I can't. I got to keep it a secret to myself. But I have over 200 pages, and my husband doesn't even know. I like to keep it to myself, because I feel if I showed anyone the first 50 pages or 100 pages and they didn't like something about it, it would undermine my confidence that I could keep going, and that which they didn't like might have been excised by the time I finish anyway. So I know a lot of writers really benefit from showing their work as they write, but I'm the kind that I just like to hole up and get the first draft all done before anyone sees it.
And be nice and surprised by what
Yeah.
the characters are doing.
Yeah.
And maybe curled up with a good pan of almond crescents, I would hope.
It's never bad to be curled up with a plate load of almond crescents.
Lorna, thank you so much for your time today.
I appreciate it so much. Thank you, Ashley.
That was Main Street's Ashley Thornburg talking with Lorna Landvik, author of Chronicles of a Radical Hag with Recipes. She's written many books. A few of her more recent titles include Patty Jane's House of Curl, its sequel, Once in a Blue Moon Lodge, Best to Laugh, and Mayor of the Universe. Landvik has quite a presence on Amazon.com. Coming up on Main Street, a Plains Folk essay from Tom Ezern, and a chat with Bill Sorensen about the upcoming Medora musical and his colorful career. First, the news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. The state Senate has approved a new spending plan for the proposed Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library and Museum to be built in Medora. As the Senate approved, the state will provide $50 million for the library, but the money will not come from proceeds of the Legacy Fund. Instead, $15 million will come from the general fund's ending balance for this biennium, and $35 million will be in the form of a loan from the Bank of North Dakota. That money will be used for an endowment to pay for maintenance and upkeep. That money will provide a match for $100 million in private donations. Supporters of the measure call the idea visionary. Mrs. Valley City Democratic Senator Larry Robinson.
This is big stuff. When are we ever going to be presented with an opportunity to land a presidential library in our great state?
But Jamestown Democratic Senator John Grabinger didn't like the funding mechanism.
I want the library built. I think it's great for North Dakota. It will add to tourism. It would be a legacy. But that's exactly what we should do. And we should use legacy fund earnings to do it.
Grabinger voted for the measure, but said after the debate, he hopes the funding for it will change. The vote was 34-13. It needed a two-thirds vote because of the use of its biennium's general funds. The House will now consider the measure. A certain brand of sushi has been identified as the source of 4 cases of salmonella in North Dakota. The outbreak has sickened 13 people nationwide since early January. This is State Health Department epidemiologist Laura Cronquist.
Our cases that we interviewed in North Dakota mentioned that they had eaten sushi prior to becoming ill, and a bunch of other cases in other states also mentioned that. That led to an environmental health investigation and a collection of restaurant invoices, and traceback evidence led everyone to raw ground tuna.
Cronquist could not comment on where the cases occurred in North Dakota or if any of those sickened were hospitalized. The frozen ground tuna came from a Louisiana-based company. It originated from Vietnam and sold to distributors in North Dakota, Minnesota, and 5 other states for use in finished food dishes, sold by restaurants and food retailers, and was not sold directly to consumers. The company recalled the sushi on Monday. And Grand Forks police say a 13-year-old boy has been charged with arson and endangerment by fire in connection with a Tuesday night fire at Ben Franklin Elementary School in Grand Forks. A joint investigation by the Grand Forks Fire and Police Departments and State Fire Marshal determined the fire was intentionally set. The investigation identified a suspect who was taken into custody around 9 o'clock last night. Fire crews were called to the school just before 6:30 regarding a fire in the library area. Crews were told the fire was extinguished by a custodian. Police say at the time there were students and staff in the building, but the library was not occupied. The damage estimate is being evaluated, but because of the cleanup, classes were called off for the day. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
Next time on The Pulse...
I didn't know what life was going to be like after I didn't pass, you know?
Failure makes us feel defeated.
I took that as an absolute indication that I should not be a scientist.
But in many ways, failure is a building block, something to learn from.
The next time we do an experiment, it might work out.
Reframing failure.
Tomorrow at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University, and he's the author of our Plainsfolk essays on Main Street. Today, Tom's essay looks at the story element of history and how telling a good story can serve the interests of history. Here's Tom's Heroes of German-Russian Country.
Here are a couple of things that seem far apart, but in my mind, there's a connection. We were recently returned from a research expedition to the high, dry interior of New Zealand, where we spent time with people who have established a world-class wine industry in former sheep paddocks. Marketing is crucial to them, marketing not only their vintage, but also the land in which it is made. Some of the vintners have retained high-end marketing consultants who have advised them as to the selection of archetypes for their marketing campaign. An archetype is a story symbol, something universally recurrent in human storytelling, such that it resonates with and motivates your public. The sage, the trickster, and most of all, the hero are established archetypes. This is common practice in 21st century marketing. I'm not a marketing guy, but I am a liberal arts guy, and so I know where this comes from the 1949 book by the comparative mythologist Joseph Campbell. Stay with me, because this gets a little humanities wonky, but you'll see what I'm talking about. Campbell's classic work is called The Hero with a Thousand Faces. It is the Bible on archetypes. It draws on deep knowledge of history, mythology, literature, and most of all, Jungian psychology. Whether the marketers or vintners know it or not, The Hero with a Thousand Faces animates their labors. So, home we come to our American plains, where my next expedition is to the German-Russian country of McIntosh County. In this region, I work with people interested in branding and marketing their immigrant culture for purposes of grassroots heritage tourism. I am to speak to the annual banquet of the Ashley Chamber of Commerce, and I have to talk about archetypes. German-Russian country, you see, has a default archetype housed in its folk history. It is a survivor story, the oft-told history of people beat up by despotic governments and malevolent forces. It comes perilously close to being a victim narrative. It lacks what historians today call agency. Problem is, the survivor doesn't resonate as an archetype. It evokes pity rather than empathy. Digging deeper into the history of McIntosh County, we find that embedded in the mournful stories are other archetypes. In fact, the greatest of them all, that hero with a thousand faces. Two of the most tragic tales of German-Russian country have to do with fire. The Prairie Fire of 1898 that killed Minnie Geisler and her daughter Anna, and the House Fire of 1946 that took five children of the Lang family. Well, Minnie Geisler did die in that fire, but she died a hero trying to save her daughter, and we tell and sing her story yet today. There is a hero in the middle of the Lang House Fire story, too, who speaks powerfully to us, but I'm not quite ready to talk about that yet. It is a story to be handled with sensitivity. The upshot of all this is, I see German-Russian country and perhaps the entirety of the Northern Plains as a place of pilgrimage, populated by compelling narratives that resonate with travelers. This presents a challenge. Are we good enough storytellers to handle it? Well, challenge is what heroes are made of.
Get to know the purpose of an English cathedral.
They were meant to act as a beacon for the faithful, to draw people to them.
What that purple stuff is on your plate in Slovenia.
With a lot of the eggplant spreads that we use instead of ketchup.
And how the outdoors-loving Norwegians keep their cities green.
By default, we are very environmentally friendly people.
It's on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we talk about a nearly forgotten founding father.
Dr. Benjamin Rush, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, the hero of the yellow fever epidemic in Philadelphia in 1793, and the man who gave the title to Thomas Paine's pamphlet, Common Sense.
We speak this week with the author, Stephen Fried, whose new book is Rush, Revolution, Madness, and Benjamin Rush, the visionary doctor who became a founding father.
Among other things, Dr. Rush brought Jefferson and John Adams back into correspondence after their friendship had broken apart in the hectic years around 1800, and the exchange of letters that he made happen is regarded by historians as one of the greatest in all of American history.
And Rush seems to pop up everywhere in American Revolutionary history.
He was with George Washington at the crossing of the Delaware.
Please join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Bill Sorensen. He's the Medora musical co-host, well-known North Dakotan all around the state, and he joins us from our studio in Bismarck. Bill, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invite.
Let's do a little Bill Sorensen biography here. How did you get started in show business?
Oh, boy. You know, I was kind of the shy, bashful guy in school, so I don't know how that happened. But it was my interest in magic, actually. I was as a youngster, I had an interest in magic, and I just never grew up. So I just kept doing it. Most people grow out of that stage, and I didn't. So it's been a big part of my life. Been fun.
Well, you were at Concordia College in Moorhead about the same time I was across the road at Moorhead State. And you started out in government, didn't you, shortly after that?
I did start out shortly after that. I'm not supposed to, though. You know, I'm supposed to tell everybody Concordia has got that C-400 thing going.
Yeah.
You know, where you send them money. But they give me money every month if I tell people that I went to Moorhead State. So.
Well, we'd be proud to have you as a dragon. So you got started in the Bismarck City Commission as a pretty young fellow, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I did run. I ran on one of those things when I didn't think I'd get elected, but I had an interest and ran and was fortunate enough to get elected.
So 10 years after you graduate from high school, you're running the city.
Well, it was a fun time to be involved in city government in Bismarck. There was a lot going on, and I was very happy, humbled, and proud to be a part of it.
And then you graduated from the commission to the mayor's chair.
Yeah. Spent a little time in the legislature for a couple of terms in between, but then I took a shot at mayor.
And because I've studied you online, Bill Sorensen, I can tell that. You're the past president of the North Dakota League of Cities, so kudos to you for all of that. Let's talk about this Medora musical, which is coming up. It's been an absolute tourist magnet for a long, long time, and you've been associated with Medora for a long time. How did that all get going?
I fell in love with Medora at a young age. I actually had a leave of absence. I was working at Concordia way back in 1976 and took a leave for the summer, and I did a show in Medora called the Bicentennial Review for the Bicentennial Year. And I knew when I left that fall and was going back to Concordia that I was going to return to Medora because it got its hook into me, and it's my happy place.
So you would have known Harold Schaefer.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that was a lot of the reason why I fell in love with the place. I thought he was an unbelievable man, and it was fun to be a part of his life.
I've seen the Medora musical a couple of times, and it's a good show. It's a really strong pro show. Tell us about this year's show.
Well, this year's show, we got a couple North Dakota kids in it, so that'll be fun. I have not seen the whole script yet. I'm hoping they take it easy on me because I don't know when along this path that we've been talking about, Scott, but I got old at some point, and so I'm hopefully not going to be doing any singing or dancing or backflips or anything, but the show will have some really great talent, some very experienced Burning Hill singers that are doing great things all over the world the rest of the time, and some great novelty acts this summer, so it should be fun.
How's your health? Because you had a difficult path there for a while.
Well, on a couple of different things, I've been kind of given a short life expectancy, but I blew past both of those, and I've never felt better, so I'm very, very blessed.
You are co-hosting with Chet Wolin. What's that like?
Is he back again this year?
He's back again this year.
Jeez. Yeah. Didn't tell me that. Maybe I'd have reconsidered. No, he's great. We have a tendency, the two of us, to go off script a little bit, which can be a problem, but we have a lot of fun.
Well, I'm quoting something from online about you, and it's about Chet, and it says, sometimes Chet gets this little glimmer in his eye, and it reminds me of when he was a little kid, and I just think to myself, here we go, we're going off script. So how long have you known this guy?
His dad is the producer. His dad was a Burning Hill singer, and I knew him way back then. And he's been a producer now for 20-plus years in Medora Musical. So I knew Chet when he was running around the chuck wagon, former eating place, and hiding under tables and things. So, I know how rambunctious he can be.
Okay. Well, the Medora Musical, for those people who haven't seen it, you can certainly go online and see what it looks like. It's outside.
It's amazing. I forget because I've been associated there for a long time until I talk to people that come from different places, and they say, you don't go to a show like this where there's horses riding up bluffs and all this talented the singers and dancers and things. This is unique, and I guess it is unique. We're fortunate to have it.
Well, what kind of weather have you had to put up with?
You don't even want to know.
Well, I do, too. I'm asking the question.
We're like the Postal Service. Neither wind nor rain nor snow nor sleet. We've seen it all. We obviously have some rainouts, but very few. Very few. And then there's some few days that's – I think we started the show and it's 109 on stage one night last year.
Good heaven.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful location, and it's actually quite comfortable to watch it now. There's even an escalator there, isn't there?
Yeah. Back in the olden days when I first started, you walk down a long, long pathway to get there and had to walk all the way back up. But now we've made it much better with these long escalators to get you up and down.
Well, the Medora musical isn't the only thing you've been doing at Medora. You've also got this act coming up, don't you? A magical slant house?
Oh, yeah. I thought you were going to talk about something else. Yeah, the slant house is exciting. Sometimes they're called gravity houses, but I went to one when I was young in California, and I went to another one that I think has since closed in Wisconsin Dells, and I've been fascinated with just optical illusions because of my magic background. So this whole idea of this place that kind of questions what you see, you know, that everything you see is not really what's going on or what you're seeing. And so we have several exhibits, several different interactive displays, and then this slant house where things is going to throw your senses off a little bit. You're going to think something's happening, something else happens.
So, is it hard to build a slant house?
You know, I've got two friends. I'm very fortunate I have two friends that are very talented contractors but are also very creative guys. And the one is I actually know from Medora. He's my partner in that project. His name's Don Otto. And he was a variety act in the Medora musical many, many years ago, and we've just stayed friends. And he actually was the national high dive champion and the national trampoline champion the same year. So his act was diving off a diving board onto this trampoline.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. But anyway, he's now building the slant house when, you know, you try to make everything straight and now you're building something where you try to make everything crooked was kind of right up his alley. He was
Well, will you also be performing on the Sorensen stage at the Old Town Hall Theater?
Wow. You did do your background checks.
Yeah.
Yeah. A guy by the name of Clyde Bauman, Milo Hudson-Buehler, and I did 2,000 plus shows in that theater over those many years that I've been out there. So that might be how I phase out. Now that I'm going to be done with the musical, maybe I'll go back and do something there all summer, next summer. But I am going to do some shows this year. Our President Joe Wigan, who portrays President Roosevelt there, is going to be gone some days. So, yeah, I'm going to get a chance to go do something at that theater as well.
Well, I noted that Sorensen Stage is spelled the same way as your last name. So what's the connection?
Just that I did a couple thousand shows there.
There you go.
And they were nice enough to remodel the stage and name it after me. So that was cool.
Well, some people also might know or remember that you once managed a North Dakota boxer, Virgil Hill. He's in the Hall of Fame, I guess.
Yeah. You know what? I'm glad you mentioned him because I'd like to now get him in the North Dakota Hall of Fame as well as a Teddy Roosevelt Award winner. You know, I don't know anyone in my life that's gone out of their way to promote North Dakota like he has. It was unbelievable during his run there that he would just exploit on the wonderfulness of North Dakota everywhere we were in the world.
And how old is he now?
He is now, let's see, let me figure that out, 50 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
So past boxing, I hope.
Yes. Well, for sure with my involvement, that's for sure.
Okay, but you were working with Don King when Virgil was boxing, right?
Yes. We don't like to talk about that, but yes.
You were Don, huh?
Yeah. It was interesting negotiations, let's put it that way.
Okay, well, he's a colorful character,
yeah,
for sure.
That there's no question about that.
And you founded the Bismarck Wizards basketball team. You have been busy, Bill.
Well, that was fun. We actually started the whole league. Fargo had a team as well back then.
The Bees?
Bees, the FMBs. And it was fun. And my coach just lost his job with the Sacramento Kings the other day, so I'm hoping he lands with another NBA team, one of the great young men that came through Bismarck at that time. It was a great fun thing. I think it was a fun thing for the communities that had the teams, and I'm glad it's still in some form surviving.
And you were the co-owner of the short-lived Dakota Rattlers baseball team.
Okay, I wanted to see what you were reading before you started this interview. Where did you get all this information?
You're up there. You're all over, Bill.
that's where I learned to start a league. Yeah, well, that particular league, we had problems keeping the league together, but that was fun as well. It was a great experience, and I enjoyed it.
Well, let's fill in a few more of these blanks here, because we've talked about the magician, the comedian, the promoter, you know, the politician. You had a business period too, didn't you?
I did. I, you know, anything that came along, I'd give it a try. I think I started or bought 16 different businesses during my career, not all of them successful. We had started a business called Extend America with the idea of kind of making sure that cell phones got into rural areas back in the early days of cell phones. But we had a bunch of spectrum from Nextel Incorporated, and when Sprint bought out Nextel, that business kind of went away on us. But yeah, a lot of things. A lot of my businesses were related to telephones and computers.
And you still obviously keep pretty busy, Bill.
I am, you know, despite these health issues that I had, and somewhere along the line, I got old. Did it happen to you yet? Did you get old?
I've noticed a change.
You have a change. Okay, that's the term I'm using from now on.
If I don't pass a mirror, I don't notice the change.
Yeah. No, I notice it because, you know, they say there are four ages that you go through: youth, middle age, senior citizen, and you're looking good. And I've got a lot of people saying to me, oh, you're looking good. So I guess I'm there now.
Well, what is it about an audience that really gets you going?
No, boy. Yeah, I hate to admit it, that my ego or whatever, but there's something about people laughing and people having fun that is an adrenaline rush. And As I said, I never really intended that it would be part of my career, but when I look back, I've done 6,000 shows in practically every state in the nation and outside the country, and it's been just a big, fun part of my life that I hope never ends.
Well, at this stage in your life, it is kind of interesting to look back and recall, you know, when you were in high school.
Yeah.
Were you thinking, you know, someday I'll have done thousands of shows?
Yeah, not a chance. Not a chance would I have thought that back then. And even now, when I think about it, it shocks me. Like, well, how did that happen? You know, what decisions did I make along the way that led me to that? But it's been a great joy for me. I can't tell you how much I still enjoy doing shows. I think out of the 6,000 plus whatever I've done, I can honestly say I don't think there's ever been one that I've gone, oh, no, it's time to go do the show. Oh, no. I mean, I always look forward to it. I have great fun with it.
Well, let's finish here with Bill Sorensen, the family man, because I did notice that you've got four daughters, including one named Medora.
Well, you can appreciate this, living from where you are, because I tell everybody, you know, after my first summer in 1976 of doing shows in Medora, she was born that fall, so I named her Medora. And I tell her it was a good thing she came along when she did, because the next summer I was in Dilworth.
To me.
Yeah, I love that cough. You better take care of yourself.
I'm trying real hard. Well, Bill, when you look to next year, for example, when you're not co-hosting the stage at Medora for the musical, do you expect still to be there?
You know, it is my happy place. My kids, in fact, talk about Medora Dad and Regular Dad. And apparently Medora Dad was much more relaxed and much more fun than Regular Dad. So I guess I didn't know that. But I do know it's my happy place. I love everything about it. I love the fact that every day is like a reunion. I see somebody that I haven't seen for years. Every day I get to do a show or do that. Anytime I want, I can be all by my lonely in the beautiful Badlands. Yeah, it's the best of all worlds.
Do you have an opinion about the potential for a Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library there?
Yeah, well, I've actually been working pretty hard to make that pass. You know, you look at the people whose history crossed Medora, Teddy Roosevelt, and how much he loved showing off the Badlands to his friends from the East, and Harold Schaefer, and how he thought this place needs to be preserved and shared for generations to come. I think this is the next logical step. We need to recognize Teddy Roosevelt, not only because he was a great president, but because he loved this area. And if he could have his presidential library anywhere, no question he'd want it to be in Medora. So I hope it happens.
All right. Well, Bill Sorensen is the Medora musical co-host and entertainer with a broad range of experience, a politician, an exceptional citizen of the state of North Dakota. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Thank you for giving me the chance.
Dakota 8 Book is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Coming up on the next ReSound special, we trot across America from Columbia, Missouri.
The first time I heard the payphone on Cherry Street in Sixth Ring, it was 2 a.m. The street was totally empty, and I started freaking out.
Hello?
To Nashville, Tennessee.
Look at his house. Look at everything he got. Shoot, I ain't got none of that.
on the next ReSound special from the Third Coast Festival and PRX.
ReSound, this week's Prairie Public Presents, coming up Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 17th. On this date in 1914, the Devil's Lake World ran a political cartoon on page one. It showed Uncle Sam prepared to undertake a big project. He carried picks and shovels. Under one arm was a document labeled Alaska Railroad Law. Carrying railroad ties and rails, as well as a locomotive, Uncle Sam was clearly ready to go to work. Facing him was a figure representing the unemployed, saying, "Say, Uncle, do you need some help on that railroad?" Decades before FDR's New Deal, the political cartoon suggested putting the unemployed to work on an important infrastructure project. When people think of a financial crisis, the Great Depression usually comes to mind. But the financial crisis of 1914 was global. More than 50 countries experienced bank runs and financial crashes. As the year went on, almost every stock exchange in the world closed for 6 weeks. The recession began in 1913 and didn't come to an end until World War I broke out. A recession is defined as two straight quarters of contraction of the gross domestic product. While not on the scale of the Great Depression, the financial crisis of 1914 was alarming, and it hit North Dakota particularly hard. 90% of the land in the state was devoted to farming and ranching. With agricultural prices falling, farmers and ranchers suffered. That filtered into the wider community as local stores raised prices to make up for the lost business from farmers and ranchers. Everyone in the community began to shop more frugally. In turn, unemployment began to go up. The political cartoon was a suggestion that the unemployed be put to work on public works projects like the Alaskan Railway. The economy was in danger of sliding into a full-blown depression when World War I broke out. As fighting raged across Europe, orders for American goods poured in. North Dakota farmers suddenly had new markets, and they could breathe a sigh of relief. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The Trump administration has already declared victory against the Russia investigation.
No collusion.
No obstruction.
They know there was no collusion.
The collusion delusion is over.
Now the Justice Department is expected to release Robert Mueller's report to Congress. What will it reveal about the president and Russia? That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thursday on Main Street, on the day before the Good Friday holiday, News Director Dave Thompson will join us for our weekly discussion of the latest items in the news. Matt Olean will review another new movie. This one is The Aftermath. Sue Balcom will join us for a Main Street Eat segment, and we'll share our What's Happening calendar of events. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.